I'm Alexander Hefner, your host on The Open Mind. You can follow us at Open Mind TV and support our series on Patreon at patreon.com/theopenmind. I'm honored to welcome our guest today, former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold, who currently presides as president of the American Constitution Society. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Alexander, it's great. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
It's a pleasure to. Let me ask you about your most immediate work with the American Constitution Society in thinking about the opportunity for the Biden administration to make the judiciary more equitable, more representative of the American people. What is foremost on your mind in that pursuit?
Well, I do feel very fortunate that I was offered this opportunity a little over a year ago at a critical time in terms of our national judiciary. The American Constitution Society is all about making sure the courts are a place where everybody feels they can go and get a fair shot in front of a judge who they can respect, who is known positively in their community, and hopefully who might look like them in some cases. And that, of course, has not been the situation to some extent, even under Democratic nominees, but especially given the takeover of the courts by the right through the efforts of the Federalist Society and incredibly exacerbated with the Trump nominees, who were overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly male, making an already not diverse set of courts even less diverse. And we also have a terrible lack of diversity of practice, if you will, meaning that even if you have people that might affiliate on the non-conservative side, too often they are from corporate law backgrounds and do not represent people who maybe were public defenders, who defended criminal defendants, who did their practice representing unions or plaintiffs. So we feel strongly in the efforts that we have made, which I can describe later, to make sure that the names that are in front of the new Biden administration represent that kind of diversity. And in fact, we've succeeded in making those lists possible. And I have to say, so far, the Biden administration has shown a really excellent receptivity to what we're trying to do.
When it comes to Senate procedure, with which you are intimately familiar, what is most urgent now, knowing the plethora of judges on the bench who have retired or taken senior status since Biden was sworn in?
Well, you are right. It is a time of dire need to move quickly. Not irresponsibly, but quickly. And so that's why we had over 50 working groups in 37 states coming from our lawyer chapters get together starting over 2 years ago to identify people who would be good. We've vetted them to a reasonable extent so we could help the administration get the names of people who are ready to go that, in fact, are diverse, both in terms of their ethnic and demographic backgrounds and their practice, and that they can move quickly. Because frankly, in the past, that's not always happened. Even those who were in the Obama administration said things went too slowly. And we're in a very precarious situation where the Senate is controlled by the Democrats only by the vote of the vice president. Of course, that could change in 2 years. That could change at any moment. And that means it's essential to not get caught up in too slow of processes, whether it's at the White House or whether it's in the Senate. Whether senators have commissions or not, this process has to move fast in order to fill up those seats that you've described. And we think there'll be many other judges who feel comfortable taking senior status now. So time is of the essence. And that's exactly the enterprise we're involved in. And I'm grateful that the White House Counsel's Office has been very receptive to getting all the information and intelligence they can get about the possibilities that are in front of them to move quickly on judicial nominees and begin to take back the courts from the, what I call the theft by the right of the federal courts of the United States of America.
Well, it is theft. It's not representative of the will of the American people because in election cycle after election cycle, the majority is denied representation on the court. So just how quickly, Senator, can Senator Schumer and the Biden administration proceed within weeks, within days?
I certainly hope the process is within weeks, maybe a couple of weeks, where we start hearing some names being nominated. I think that the Judiciary Committee of the Senate and which I served on for 16 years, should be ready to start holding hearings in April. And that means judges can start moving to the floor, in my view, and should start moving to the floor, in May, well before the summer. Now, this will only be a down payment on trying to take back the judiciary from the far right and from the extremists, because there won't be as many openings as we would like right away. But you have to act quickly and take advantage of what's before you. And then, of course, the political winds will blow and we'll see what else happens. But this part needs to be done almost right away.
Expeditiously, and that is your intention. In terms of the expansion of the judiciary, I talked about vacancies that emerged as soon as the election result was clear. But what about the notion of a simple majority vote that could expand the federal judiciary? And then I'll ask you about the Supreme Court. But first, what about the appellate courts?
Well, there's a great need to increase the number of judges in a number of circuits and district courts where even Republicans sometimes admit there's just not enough judges to do the work. And so I think, yes, I think a majority vote would probably involve a fairly strong support from Democrats, and you might not even need any Republicans. But I think there's going to be some Republicans who may well vote to support the legislation that's already moving, I think, that would expand the number of lower court positions in certain places. So that's a very exciting prospect. It creates openings. It creates the opportunity to avoid the denial of justice in places where there aren't enough judges to do the work. So I do think that that's probably, if you will, the lowest hanging fruit in terms of legislation, and I hope it moves expeditiously.
When we talk about expansion of the lower courts, they shouldn't be called lower in the sense that they're not any less significant in making decisions in the jurisprudential outcomes. Yes, the elephant in the room is always the U.S. Supreme Court. So with respect to the U.S. Supreme Court, if a simple majority could appoint three justices who were not representative of the people, a majority of whom did not vote for Donald Trump, and a majority of whom did not vote for Republican Senate candidates in 2016, and then again in 2018, and once again in 2020, isn't there a very logical and constitutionally rooted argument that you should be able to expand the size of the Supreme Court with a simple majority in legislation in the U.S. Congress?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the easiest case to make. The American Constitution Society does not specifically endorse specific solutions for judicial reform, but we think it's critical that it be done. And there's, I think, a consensus that the least constitutionally suspect approach is simply adding or decreasing the number of justices. It is something that the Constitution clearly gives to the Congress and the President the right to do. It's been done before. At other times, there's been seven justices on the Supreme Court. It doesn't raise serious constitutional problems. And it's a question of counting. A majority should be sufficient, although there is the filibuster in the Senate. And unless they made an exception to this, there is no guarantee at all that a majority vote would be sufficient. And there's also the concern that a couple of Democrats have said they might not support increasing the number of justices. But I think it's justified not only for the reason you indicated. I think it has a lot of merit, and we want to raise that up as a possibility. But it goes even beyond who won the election and how they won the election. It's the bald and disgusting theft of two of those Supreme Court seats in an illicit process. One was the stealing of Justice Scalia's seat when President Obama should have had the right to fill it. That was a terrible abuse of process. As a former senator and member of the Judiciary Committee, I really couldn't believe that that had been done. It was unheard of and it was wrong, and there needs to be recompense or reparations for it. And the same thing goes for the tragic sudden death of Justice Ginsburg, who, of course, should have been replaced in due course by the new president. They shouldn't have done a rush job on that. So as far as I'm concerned, the current rather lopsided majority in the Supreme Court is illegitimate. It is illicit. It questions the legitimacy of the Supreme Court itself for a long time going forward, and it heightens the need to look at various forms of judicial reform, including the one you've raised, the possibility of increasing the number of seats on the Supreme Court by simple legislation.
And unlike the more sophisticated proposals or nuanced involving term limits or a lottery with a larger pool of judges or justices, this kind of simple approach of adding three judges, or at a minimum for the two judges that you identify, were unfairly appointed in a process that was not true to form, there could be that legislation. We know in legislative procedure, the filibuster is what stands in the way. You can have a 51-vote majority with the vice president as the tiebreaker. What is your position, and what is the society's position on the filibuster and the extent to which it could stymie not just that expansion of the Supreme Court, but it could stymie very quickly an expeditious process for appointing and enlarging to the federal bench on beyond the Supreme Court, the lower courts?
Well, American Constitution Society does not take a formal position on the filibuster. But we do recognize that it can't be one set of rules for one side and one set of rules for the other side. And so now you have a situation where the conservatives in the Senate have abused the process, and there is the possibility of using the rules, what is sometimes called the nuclear solution or alternative, to either eliminate the filibuster for legislation or make exceptions. So some people are talking about not completely eliminating it, but eliminating the filibuster and turning voting rights issues into a majority vote situations. I think this judicial one could be on the table for that as well. The truth is a lot of things can't be filibustered. The budget can't be. There are budget reconciliation items, fast-track trade agreements and others. You can create legislation that could change those things, and some of it can be done by, you know, the rather extreme approach that the Republicans were happy to use to change the rules in a way that is not normal. This is an issue that is so important, what I call the intergenerational theft, the theft of the courts by the hard right, by a view of very wealthy, often elderly or older billionaires, using the Federalist Society to lock down the courts, appointing young ideologues, is stealing from the younger generations of lawyers and people in this country who should have a right to have their mark on our Constitution and the future of our country through the courts. And so, you know, I think it's one of those situations where you have to at least let the other side know, if you will, speaking here of what the Democrats might do, and say, look, we have the power to do this. What are you going to do? How are you going to be reasonable? And maybe they'd come up with some kind of a compromise where the filibuster would only be lifted for some judicial situations, not the additional seats issue could be something that is sunset, that doesn't stay in place for a huge period of time, but is done for a period of recompense or reparation for what is truly outrageous theft. So there are ways in which there can be negotiations to possibly cause the Republicans to step away from the precipice and say, all right, we have to pay back for what we did here. Otherwise, they're going to change the rules permanently. So those kinds of things can happen in the Senate. Obviously, I've seen it happen. And what you can do then is negotiate a solution that brings back equity and maybe puts these norms back in place for the future. But what can't happen is that those who have been ripped off here, who have had their future denied, to have to simply take it and play by the traditional rules when the right simply refused to play by any rules at all.
I really appreciate your use of the word reparation because it is entirely appropriate, and it emphasizes the urgency of the issue and the seriousness of the constitutional violation and the violation of democratic norms, if we want to consider ourselves a democratic republic or a democracy. With respect to the narrow parameters or narrowly tailored circumstances in which you could remove the barrier of the filibuster, what comes to mind outside of judicial reform is H.R. 1, the preservation of our democracy and access to voting. And perhaps to someone like Senator Manchin, a state-of-the-art infrastructure package that would appeal to West Virginians as much as Americans across the country, but something that potentially could be negotiated, that you limit the filibuster you basically remove that barrier when it comes to H.R. 1, voting rights, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, and possibly infrastructure as a negotiating tactic. What do you think of that?
I think that's the kind of thing you can talk about and they can make sense. And I'm glad you mentioned the reparations thing because these two issues are connected. You know, I use that word advisedly, but intentionally. Reparations is, of course, often associated with the need to do something about the origins of this country involving slavery. And that has not been resolved. But the reparations here are of direct consequence for those who have been victimized in our history. The reparations that would come with regard to the Supreme Court has a lot to do with the fact that the terrible Shelby County decision and all these anti-voting things are particularly targeted at African Americans and, in an argument this week, Native Americans, who both were excluded from our original Constitution. And so the idea here of providing exceptions to the filibuster rule, if not eliminating it, does directly tie in with the need, desperate need for a reckoning on racial justice in this country that has not yet happened. And so why not talk about a grand bargain that would include judicial reform, that could include, as you suggested, the campaign finance and H.R. 1 issues about voting rights and possibly transportation. There are certainly precedents for that kind of a grand bargain in the past where we as an organization don't endorse it. But in answer to your question, there is no fundamental reason or anything terribly wrong with linking these issues at a time when this country needs action on things all the way from voting rights to transportation that have simply been ignored or consciously attacked in the last few years.
It's not clear if the Biden administration is there. I think someone like Ron Klain is aware of the fundamental need for that reparation or those reparations. It sounds like from your dialogue with the White House and your capacity at the society and as a former colleague of President Biden's and others in the chamber that you have confidence that they are prepared in these next 2 years before the next midterm cycle to go in this direction and to make a grand bargain to preserve our democracy.
I do. I think that the president and Ron Klain is one of the original people that helped found the American Constitution Society. They clearly are devoted to the issue of what's happened to the federal judiciary. I mean, I was on judiciary with Joe Biden. He was on there for about 40 years. He knows this issue in and out, and he cares about it. But he also cares about the infrastructure issues, and he surely cares about the racial justice issues. The legislation he's been proposing, the things he's been doing, the nominations he's been making are all in the direction of an understanding that everything from COVID-19 to the harm to the economy all have impacted African-Americans particularly harshly. And I'm excited. I think he wants his legacy to be the president who really took these issues of racial justice and the related issues seriously. So what form it would take, whether it would take the form of reparations, whether reparations is the term or the approach that is taken, that we don't know. But I do think that they want their legacy to be that they help move this country in the right direction on racial justice.
The basic point, though, is that our democracy may not survive 2022 or 2024 if the John Lewis Voting Rights Act doesn't restore basic protections of the franchise, if elements of H.R. 1 and judicial reform are not integrated into our system. It's not clear to me that this illiberal backsliding of democratic norms, whether it's our system is salvageable if those things don't occur in the next 2 years.
Well, there's always hope that you can repair things, but even though January 6th was an attempt to do it all one day, the truth is that the attempt to capture the various avenues of government are all over the place, and the right is driving it, funded by very extreme people. So you have what's already been done to the courts and the theft of the Supreme Court. You have the abuse of the filibuster in the Senate to prevent things like real voting rights reform. You have the phenomenon of a president that we just had who was willing to disregard just about every legitimate norm that our Justice Department always followed in order to make sure that people knew the Justice Department were their lawyers and not the lawyers for the for the president. And you have it going on at the state level. As you know, the number of anti-voting bills that have been introduced in the last few weeks is astonishing. And at the same time, there are groups that are trying to pass a resolutions to call a constitutional convention for the first time in the history of this country that I think would be open-ended to create an extreme right-wing revamping of the Constitution. And we need to be on the lookout for that as well. So, yes, my answer to your question, Alexander, is that overall, this is an attempt to diminish or destroy what we really understand as democracy in this country.
So the acuteness of urgency is there not only in saving lives during this pandemic, but preserving our democracy. You're someone who understands it more fully than most, because you and the late Senator John McCain wanted to preserve the integrity of our election process. And the law of the land for a certain period of time was governed by legislation that you developed in concert with Senator McCain, Congressman Meehan, and Shays. That landmark legislation was relatively somewhat invalidated by the Supreme Court, but it shows how important the court is in basically ascertaining what are the rules of the road for our democracy. But the reason that I mentioned the urgency is because you've seen the arc and you've seen it devolve in a direction that basically doesn't allow for accountability of our elections.
I mean, you're fundamentally right, of course, that you have to tell the story of what happened here. So, you know, this country realized during the period of the late 19th century, the Gilded Age, that the oil companies and others were not only completely dominating the economy, but they were starting to completely control the election. And so in 1907, something called the Tillman Act was passed by the Senate and signed by Theodore Roosevelt. And that basically said corporations can't contribute to political campaigns. It's enough that they control the economy. And that was the law of the land until 2010. And what John McCain and I did was figure out after there was an abuse developed, sadly, partly by the Clinton-Gore administration, something called soft money that sort of got around this and sort of funneled money through the political parties. And we wanted to crack down on that loophole that was beginning to destroy the process. And we succeeded. And that ban on soft money not only passed, went to the Supreme Court, and was survived in the McConnell versus FEC case. So, and that continues to be the law of the land. You still cannot give unlimited contributions, corporations and others can't, to the political party mechanisms. Well, you are right. Our bill was completely undermined by the Supreme Court in 2010 in Citizens United when they invalidated this bill I just talked about. They invalidated the law called the Tillman Act. So nobody had even seriously said there was anything wrong with that. And they came up with this notion that corporations are people like everybody else for purposes of political speech, which is absurd in my view. And it is one of the worst decisions in the history of the Supreme Court, along with Bush v. Gore and Dred Scott and some of the others. And you are correct that it has turned what we tried to do into something that is, you know, relatively minor. If we could overturn Citizens United, it would be very significant. But that is where we're at. And that's why your reference to H.R. 1, which is crafted, House Bill 1, which is crafted to do a number of things that would survive even under Citizens United, is so smart, because it's going to take a while to be able to change the Supreme Court in a way that Citizens United could be overturned. I am confident it will be overturned someday because it's such a terrible decision, so unjustified, without a record to justify the assumptions about corporations. But this needs to be chipped away at by legislation, both at the federal level and at the state level. The states can do things like this as well.
And ultimately, H.R. 1, would the constitutionality of H.R. 1 would be determined by that same U.S. Supreme Court, which is why this conversation may seem circular, but for good reason, because H.R. 1 could be overruled by the court, basically, in effect, deemed unconstitutional.
Well, there are so many provisions in the bill that unless it was inseparable, they would have to be considered separately. I think some things they could try to strike down. other things are going to be awfully hard. I mean, there are vouchers in there, the voluntary vouchers for campaigns that there's no really jurisprudence at all that suggests that that would be invalid. So they would have to go some distance. And yet this Supreme Court, as bad as it's been on campaign finance, has never struck down McCain-Feingold, even though Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas tried to. The Chief Justice Roberts said no, and they've tried several times. Now that may change, but there is a sign there that there is just a limit to how far some of the judges, and I hope half of them, will go to say that Congress can't. What they basically be saying is Congress can't act on campaign finance, which is absurd, that it is the right of the Congress to be able to do that within constitutional limits. So I don't think the HR 1 people should be discouraged. Make sure the bill is severable, meaning that the court can't say just because this part is invalid, the whole bill is invalid. That's something we had to fight out in McCain-Feingold. As long as you do that, things can be struck down. For example, yes, part of McCain-Feingold was struck down. The so-called phony issue ad provision was struck down, but the soft money ban wasn't. The Millionaires Amendment was struck down, but the campaign limits were not struck down. So that's where the court has some flexibility, but they can't use the excuse that one little piece is unconstitutional to strike down the whole thing if the Congress does a careful job of making it clear that they can, that they need to rule on these items separately.
Final question, Senator. When you think of the Wisconsin political landscape and the two-term senator from your home state who has demonstrated himself to be really an extremist, and the fact that he's up for re-election, what do you think would be the most effective, the effective strategy? Is it the Biden-Evers strategy? And if so, what is that strategy that pulled Wisconsin back to its progressive roots, even if it was by a hair still?
Well, I'm very constrained in talking about political strategy as president of the ACS because we don't do partisan politics. But, you know, this will be a test of what kind of a country people want. They want a country where people who are in office are encouraged to distort the truth or deny the obvious results of elections and encourage behavior that led to January 6th. Or do they want us to get back to a country where you can talk to each other and work together to solve problems? And that's what's going to be at stake. It's at stake in every election. It was certainly at stake in the last election, and it will certainly be at stake in 2022. And so I will leave it to those who now do political strategy, which I do not, to figure it out. But I have confidence that they are working hard on it.
Senator Feingold, thank you so much for your insight today.
It was fun. Thank you. I look forward to coming on again someday if you like.